Welcome to Accessible Authors in Mid-Continent Public Library podcast with John and Pat. We are happy to introduce best-selling author Sarah Paretsky. Sarah is best known for her mystery series starring V.I. Warshawski. Sarah has received the most prestigious awards in fiction, including the Golden Dagger Award, the Anthony, the Grand Master, the British Cartier Diamond Dagger Award, and this interview opportunity is co-sponsored by Rainy Day Books. Oh, Brushback is the latest book in the V.I. Warshawski series. Can you tell us a little bit about your new book?
Brushback is a book about, love and loss and family secrets. I'm always amazed at the things that families want to cover up. In my own family, my grandparents had a child before they were married, and this was such a source of shame that gave the child to a neighbor to raise, and it only came out at my grandfather's funeral. And I'm like, why put generations through that kind of misery? But every family that I've ever known has a secret that to the outside world doesn't look like much. Well, in V.I. Warshawski's world, the buried family secrets often are the cause of a lot of mayhem, even murder, and that's especially true in Brushback.
What was your inspiration for this book, the family secrets that you've heard through your family and other families?
It was partly wanting to write about that, about the way in which the country of the past continues to haunt the country of the present. And it also, frankly, was a book that I wanted to write to have a chance to have a chase scene under the stands at Wrigley Field. Okay. So I had been told by someone who leads tours there that when the building was built in the 1920s, it's not well built underneath. It's poured concrete. You can't change it without really blowing the whole place up and starting over again from the beginning. And he was especially dwelling on the fact that there was a toilet that hadn't been flushed in 60 years. And I thought, what a place for a chase scene. I couldn't get the Cubs to let me in to look at it. I kept calling them, sending them emails. They never returned my calls. So I finally thought, well, guys, you had your chance now. I'm making it up. And that was, for me, the most fun part of the book, was with writing that scene.
We find that some of our customers seek out series titles because of the relationship they've established with the characters. And so how do you keep it fresh?
I think that's the biggest challenge for us writing about a series character, is you want the people who've been with you from the beginning or for a long time to get new information, but you want people who've never read anything in the series before to feel at home with the character and not feel that they had to have read all 16 previous books to know who she is and what her family history is. I keep the stories fresh because I really only write about the things that I care about. I wrote one book in the series where I was under contract and I had to kind of manufacture a plot and get it done by a deadline, and it's the book that I'm most unhappy with. And ever since then I've said the story has to come to me. It can't be something that I make up just to meet a deadline.
How are you similar to your character?
How am I similar to my character? We both speak first and think second. What's different with V.I. is that she is physically strong enough to back it up if the person that she's spoken to off the top of her head comes after her, and I'm not. So I've perfected how to run away and hide.
So we've been on a whirlwind tour, it sounds like. What is a regular day in the life of an author like?
On days when I'm at home in between books, it's a very dull life, and I kind of like it that way. Unfortunately, insomnia is one of my biggest skills, so I'm not a good sleeper. I wish I slept late. I don't. I get up. I make coffee. I go out in the garden with the dog. I take the dog for a walk. I answer emails. I think, I must get started, I must get started. 10 a.m. is my official start time, and then around 2 in the afternoon, I actually have done all of the time-wasting things I can think of to avoid the blinking cursor and the blank screen, and usually sit down and write between about 2 and 8, which means late dinner, which they tell you if you have insomnia, don't eat right before you go to bed, but then I'm going to bed and then I'm waking, never mind. It's a very dull life, actually.
Can you tell us about Sisters in Crime and what is or was your role in it?
Sisters in Crime is an organization that I helped start, and really I was the person who galvanized the mystery world into creating Sisters in Crime back in the 1980s. I was starting to, my first book was published in 1982 and got a lot of good reviews, not great sales, but a lot of good critical attention. Libraries are the most important buyer today and also back when I was starting out for new writers and for mid-list writers. Writers are our biggest market. Even today, they represent 35% of my book sales. So libraries enthusiastically bought my book, and they bought 2,500 of the 3,500 copies that were sold, which meant I had a career. I was asked to write another book. But what I found was, as I started learning about the profession, was that libraries buy based on seeing at least 2 and sometimes 3 nationally juried reviews of a book, and that for women it was much harder to get review attention. And I started hearing a lot about this and a lot of other issues that were facing women writers. So we started Sisters in Crime as a way of trying to both get data on the industry and see how it was affecting women and see what kind of advocacy we could do for women. And what we found when we ran the numbers was that a mystery by a man was 7 times more likely to be reviewed than a mystery by a woman. And we thought, well, maybe men write twice as well as we do, but we don't think they write 7 times as well as we do. So we started a lot of programs to bring our books to the attention directly of libraries and booksellers, and Sisters continues to have a very close relationship with the American Library Association.
Did you find that there were certain publications that would favor men over women, or was it just all across the board?
Publishers Weekly then and now tends to cover everyone, but the big New York Times was a big offender, for instance. The big daily papers, and you've got to remember that 35 years ago, is that 29 years ago, however long it was, 30 years ago, their newspapers were extremely important, and there were hundreds of them, and it was before the big consolidation in the newspaper business. So newspapers were really the biggest offenders, but they also were very responsive when we started trying to do some consciousness raising with them. What we've learned over the years, even now, is when we stop monitoring them, they go back to their bad old ways, so we've never been able to stop our monitoring project.
Well, it seems like you are making inroads to the publishing world, but it also seems that you're still involved in that because you are part of the group Authors United. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Is this Doug Preston's group?
I think so, with the Amazon.
Yes.
Amazon?
Well, I can't really talk a lot about it because I don't have a lot of the details at my fingertips, but it's Amazon was involved in a dispute with, there are essentially 5 publishers now, and Amazon was involved in a dispute with the conglomerate Hachette, and it had to do with how, you know, Amazon is always trying to get publishers to take less and less money, which means less and less money for writers. And when Hachette would not sign the deal with Amazon, Amazon stopped carrying books by Hachette writers, which include books published by Little Brown in this country. At the time, my English publisher is a subsidiary of Hachette, and while that dispute was going on, Amazon in the United Kingdom would not carry my books on their website. So we felt, or Doug Preston, who really spearheaded this, just felt that however much Amazon may say that they're there for the writer, they're not, that they're punishing writers by not making their books available. Amazon sells over a third of books in all media throughout the Western world, not just in the United States. They are, in effect, a monopoly. And they have enormous power, and we have no power, but we're trying to fight back in our tiny, feeble way.
And lastly, who do you think VI would invite to a dinner party?
Well, of course she would invite Lottie Herschel, her close friend and mentor. Who else would she invite? I think she might like to have a lot of the women who were groundbreaking investigators. So Anna Catherine Green was a writer in the 1860s, 70s, who created a detective, a consulting detective, about 10 years before Sherlock Holmes. And he had a female, not a sidekick, but an amateur, who often observed the kind of details that Sherlock Holmes did, Amelia Peabody. So VI would invite Amelia Peabody. Baroness Ortsey, who wrote The Scarlet Pimpernel, she had a detective whose name I can't remember, but VI would no doubt invite that woman. And then moving forward in time, she would have to have Georgia Strangeways, who solved a really scary mystery for Nicholas Blake in 1939. And my personal favorite, Amanda Fitton, who was an aircraft designer in the Marjorie Allingham series.
Well, thank you so much for spending some time with us. And you are simply lovely, and we wish you great success.
Well, thank you, and thanks for your interest. I really appreciate it.
You're quite welcome, and have a good evening also.